Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Concorde, the thrilling account of history's most extraordinary airliner. The definitive account of the rise and fall of the iconic Concorde from British Airways' former chief Concorde pilot. It's been described as a remarkable story by the Daily Express and by Flyer, who put it most succinctly by saying, it's a stonking good read. What was it like to fly faster than a bullet? Could you really glimpse the edge of space? And will we ever see Concorde's like again? Mike Bannister was British Airways' chief Concorde pilot, one of the few who flew it during the quarter century of its time in the air. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from somewhere, I believe, in the UK. Mike Bannister himself. Mike, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Yeah, there we go. You see, we are beset by technical problems that perhaps Concorde wasn't in. She was a beauty, wasn't she? I mean, there's never been a plane like her. There's never going to be a plane like her ever again. And it's just one of them. And we use the word iconic too much, but my goodness, as soon as you saw that shape, you knew what it was.
Well, absolutely. And all the psychologists said to us when Concorde was flying that she was attractive because she appealed to both sides of the brain. She appealed to the technical side because everybody knew what technical, wonderful achievements she could do, faster than the speed of sound, faster than the Earth rotates, 1,350 miles an hour on the edge of space where the sky got darker, where you could see the curvature of the Earth. You're literally traveling faster than time. You'd leave London at 11 a.m. and arrive in New York at 9:20. So everybody knew that stuff, but also everybody knew that she was beautiful. Just to look at that shape in the sky was gorgeous, reminded most people of the paper darts they made when they were a child. And so consequently, she always stopped people in the streets to stop and look up as she flew over. Absolutely gorgeous aeroplane, and I was delighted and honoured to have the privilege to fly her for 22 years.
Yeah, I was just saying before we went on air that, you know, I was living in London in the 90s, and I'd be walking along the embankment, you know, somewhere near Battersea, and you'd hear that familiar sound, and you'd look up, and it was part of London life to have her flying over.
Absolutely, and I live near Heathrow in the Weybridge-Walton area, and she'd fly over there six times, sometimes eight times a day, as I say, for 27 years in service. And everybody would still stop and look up. And yeah, okay, she was a little bit noisier than modern aircraft, but nobody worried about that because it was a distinctive sound. Everybody stopped. Everybody looked up. Everybody said, there's Concorde. Not there's a Concorde, there's Concorde. Unlike all other aeroplanes, she was just Concorde, not A747 or AA320, and had a part in everyone's heart, particularly in the UK and France, because they were the two countries that developed her. And the taxpayers supported her development. So everybody felt they owned a little bit of Concorde, which made them even more interested in her entire story.
So when did you first sort of Concorde first come on your, and excuse the pun, on your radar? I mean, you know, how was because obviously it's this great project between the British and the French. It defines, if you like, because let's set it in context. It's the late 60s. We were a brave new world. The Americans are sending up the Apollos to the moon. You know, we're looking to the future. Everything is rose. The economy is booming. It's swinging London, if you like. And there is this fabulous new plane being developed.
Absolutely. And she was the born of a collaboration and a treaty between the UK and France in 1962. But she was more pan-European than that. I mean, the undercarriage was developed by Hispano Suiza in Spain. So it was a real trans-European project. And yes, she certainly captured everybody's minds at a time when Britain was, as you say, the swinging 60s. I was lucky enough once to have dinner with Neil Armstrong, the first man on the moon. And we were chatting about this and that, and talking about Concorde, and he said to me, totally unprompted, that the technical achievement of flying Concorde day in and day out with 100 passengers at twice the speed of sound was the equivalent of putting man on the moon, technically. And of course, this conversation took place in the early 80s, and they'd stopped putting men on the moon in the 70s, and we carried on flying and putting people at twice the speed of sound well into the 2000s. So it was a really amazing technical achievement, born in the 60s. And so to think that the designers, the engineers got it right first time, it is a real tribute to the ability of the individuals involved.
So, I mean, you're sort of chief pilot. How many are in the, because obviously, as a small boy in the 70s, we all had the Concorde posters, and it just seemed to like, I mean, forget the Apollo moonshots. I mean, the dials and the levers and the spinning little clocks that we seem to see on the Concorde was frightfully baffling. So, obviously, it wasn't just you going up there. It was very much a team effort.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was a little boy of seven who wanted to be a pilot. And as I say in the book, I was bitten by that bug and told my mum and dad that's what I wanted to do at the age of seven. And they said, yes, dear. Well, it all fell into place. And I can remember in 1969 watching the British assembled Concorde fly for the first time. And I thought, that's what I want to do. I want to be a Concorde pilot. It took a little while. I joined BOAC and flew the VC-10 for 8 years. But my opportunity came, and that's what we did. We operated Concorde as a crew, two pilots and a flight engineer, the engineer being a fully qualified engineer. It was such a complex aeroplane that it would take a fully experienced crew, where the captain's been with the airline for 25 years, 6 months to learn to fly Concorde, as opposed to just 2 months to learn to fly anything else. But it was worth it, because from a pilot's perspective, she was an absolute joy. You could fly her with your fingertips. From takeoff, climb, acceleration, supersonic cruise, deceleration, descent, and landing. And, of course, everybody on board was enthusiastic, and we got to see some very, very interesting customers.
I'm sure you did, but it must have been quite interesting at that point, because we're cutting edge. And the thing was, obviously, as you built up speed, the nose came up and covered.
Yeah.
So you couldn't see where you were going, but you could kind of see where you'd been, if you like.
Not quite like that, although the prototypes, you couldn't see where you were going because the nose was solid metal. But apocryphally, the chief test pilot, Brian Trubshaw, came back from a flight and told the engineers it would be a really good idea if the pilots could see where they were going. So after that, they put a glass visor. So what happens is, because the airplane flies aerodynamically differently to a conventional airplane, you have to be very nose up for slow speed. And to get over the problem of not being able to see the runway, we could dip the nose and visor, and you could come in with a just as good, if not a better view, than a conventional airplane. And at 60,000 feet, with the nose and visor up at 1,350 miles an hour, I could look out of the window and see 250,000 square miles of the Earth's surface. And it just looked like a map. You're flying across, let's say, the Mediterranean, looking down on Cyprus, it looked like the schoolboy's map beneath us. And the other fascinating thing was we're going over twice as fast as any other aeroplane. So going across the Atlantic, you'd see 747s going to New York as well as we were, but they'd appear to go backwards in the sky at 700 miles an hour.
Is it true that the Concorde, because here comes my knowledge of physics, okay, so brace yourself, Mike. But if you are going at that speed, at that height, you are generating friction, and you cannot have a reaction, because you're generating intense heat, and you cannot have that much the heat's going without something happening. Was it true that there were metal plates in Concorde that would move as you flew, basically?
Yeah, of course, as you go that quickly, it is friction, but it's also compression, because you're traveling faster than the air molecules can get out of the way. So you're compressing them all the time, and compression causes heat. And the temperature of Concorde would get up to 127 degrees Celsius on the nose and 100 degrees Celsius on the wing and the outside fuselage, the boiling point of water. And of course, anything that gets that hot is going to expand. And if you're flying at twice the speed of sound for over 3 hours, as Concorde could do, it could expand quite a lot, between 6 and 10 inches in length. Now, fortunately, the designers worked that out in advance. And so there were expansion positions throughout the entire aeroplane. Also, fortunately, as she descended, she cooled down and contracted again back to the right length. But in flight at twice the speed of sound, there was one gap on the flight deck where you could see the expansion. It was between the flight engineer's panel and the instrumentation behind it. And on the ground, you couldn't get your fingertips into this little gap, but up at twice the speed of sound, you could get your entire hand in there. And on the very last flights, when we delivered Concorde to their final resting places around the world, we put the flight engineer's hat in that gap, because it was the last time the flight engineer was going to operate any aeroplane with British Airways. So as a tribute to them, in went the hat. And of course, as soon as the airplane slowed down, descended, decelerated, and cooled down, Concorde contracted again, and the hat's trapped in there until Concorde next goes at twice the speed of sound, which sadly it never will.
Wow, amazing. It's just, it's a good job it contracted. Otherwise, you'd have a Concorde that grew sort of 3 foot a year or something like that, wouldn't you? What's it like that? I mean, what's the, because we know that we'll talk about the passengers and the lifestyle experience that was Concorde, but to fly, nobody's gone that quickly commercially. The noise, buffering, I mean, obviously, you know, a little bit further back from where you are at the sharp end, it's a little more luxurious. But is it quite an immersive experience, can we say? Was there a noise? Was there heat? Is there, you know, are you aware that you're doing that speed, apart from obviously seeing the occasional 747 going backwards and something else in a Skylab going up or something like that?
No, you couldn't. And that was one of the really clever things the designers got right. Sitting in the cabin, you had no internal indication of the speed you were traveling. And because of that, we had to put indicators in the cabin to tell the customers what height they were at and what speed they were going, because otherwise they wouldn't know. And apocryphally, George Edwards, who was the leading project manager in the British side of the development, once spoke to a lady customer who had flown on one of the early development flights in the early 70s. And she was an 85-year-old lady who'd never flown before. And he said to her after the flight, "Madam, did you enjoy that?" And she said to him, "Well, yes, but I was a little disappointed." And he said, "Disappointed? Why?" And she said, "Well, because when we went through the sound barrier, there was absolutely no sensation." Well, she was building on her expectations, having watched black and white movies where aircraft trying to go through the sound barrier was shaken and buffeted, and there was none of that on Concorde. And George Edwards looked her straight in the eye and said, "Madam, that's the clever bit." And going through the sound barrier, there was absolutely no sensation whatsoever on board the airplane. The only way that we as pilots could tell we'd done it, there was one particular instrument on the flight deck. As the shockwave passed its sensor, it went haywire for a couple of seconds. Other than that, absolutely smooth transition from slower than the speed of sound through the speed of sound and up to 1,350 miles an hour, 23 miles a minute, a mile every 2.75 seconds. And, you know, you're over 11 kilometers high. Quite amazing.
Absolutely. And of course, we're talking sort of 69 into the early 70s. It's the halcyon time, if you like, of flight. Flight is becoming more and more accessible to the everyday person. But Concorde, obviously, there was no economy on Concorde. It was the flagship. It was the best of pan-European. British Airways were obviously justly proud of this. And you know, although Concorde was, I mean, I had friends who've been on Concorde said they were surprised how it was a little bit cramped inside. I mean, it was an awful legroom, but that's because you were doing incredible speeds, and they made up for it in the service, in the wines, in the catering.
Well, of course, it was built at the time when its contemporaries, the 707 and the VC-10, also had small, relatively narrow fuselages and cabins. What's happened since Concorde came into service in 1976, larger, bigger, wider-bodied aeroplanes have come into operation, and we, the travelling public, have got used to having a wide-bodied aeroplane. Concorde was of its time. It had to be relatively narrow to travel at that speed, but it was still exceedingly comfortable. Actually, there was a lot of legroom. The seat pitch was 37 inches. I'm not very tall, but there were passengers we carried that were 6'4", quite comfortably. The tallest pilot we ever had was 6'4". The shortest, by the way, was 5'4". And of course, you're not in the aeroplane for very long. You're only in it. The flight time is 3 hours and 20 minutes. So effectively, it's a comparison in flight time to a short-haul flight. And short-haul flights these days, I think you'll find that the seat pitch is significantly less than 37 inches, and the seats are significantly narrower than they were on Concorde. And everybody on board felt comfortable. They got to know each other. The customers got to know each other and have become friends. They became friends with the crew. And some people traveled many, many times. The lead passenger traveled on Concorde well over 500 times.
Because again, and you know, and kids ask your parents, but in a pre-internet world, London to New York, and in, you know, an important business route, obviously, so people would be back and forth, the stuff they couldn't do on the phone. I will, of course, being a teenager in the 80s, I will famously remember Concorde in 1985 for Live Aid, and Phil Collins doing that, which would have been impossible for him to do if obviously Concorde hadn't been around, playing one one gig in the same day in Wembley, and then jetting off on Concorde to Philadelphia via New York, obviously. What were the memories of that particular day, and how the crew and everybody sort of reacted? There must have been a tremendous pride with that one as well.
It was symbolic of what Concorde was able to do. As you mentioned, you know, she could cross the Atlantic so quickly that you arrived in the United States an hour and 40 minutes in local time before you left the UK. 5% of our customers did that. They would go to New York and back in a day. We had facilities at Kennedy that enabled us to offer 4.5 hours in a conference room for business meetings. So you'd leave home at, say, 8:30 in the morning. You'd be back home about just before 11 o'clock at night, having been to New York and back and done 4.5 hours of business. The trip that Phil Collins did just was symbolic of all that. The mere fact that somebody could perform one charity concert in London and then another charity concert in Philadelphia at roughly the same time on the same day was absolutely amazing. But that's what was happening day in and day out for the 2.5 million people who flew on Concorde during its service time with British Airways. And of course, we as crew got the same benefits. So it was very good for a healthy lifestyle to travel on a very fast aeroplane.
Yeah, I was going to say, what does that do to you? Because we talk about people doing long haul flights, obviously, there and back again sort of situation. It does sometimes muck with their metabolism and the where am I, what day it is. But with Concorde, I suppose, it must have been, you know, you were blinking, you were back home in West London, basically.
Well, yeah, you're traveling in an airplane where the cabin pressurization is equivalent to only 5,000 feet as opposed to, let's say, 8,000 feet on a conventional airplane. You're only in it for 3 hours and 20 minutes as opposed to 8 hours. So you're up a 5,000-foot hill for 3 hours and 20 minutes as opposed to an 8,000-foot mountain for 8 hours. That makes a big difference to metabolism, to jet lag. And the other amazing thing was, because you're traveling faster than the Earth rotates, the sun appears to go backwards in the sky, and that resets the body clock. And the best way of seeing that was in the spring or the autumn, where one of our later flights would take off from London for New York in the pitch darkness, and you're traveling so quickly that the sun rises in the west. And you then see a full day as you come in towards New York, you land in broad daylight, and as you're going into Manhattan, the sun sets again. So the second sunrise and the second sunset of the day really indicated what you'd actually done. You'd traveled faster than the Earth rotates.
Of course, it wasn't just the London sort of New York routes or the Paris New York routes. There were obvious people who wanted to go up in Concorde. There were flights up to see Father Christmas, etc. And it was on one of these type of flights that the tragedy happened and brought about the end to the aircraft itself, or at least the commercial operation of it. And as always at Concorde, it was almost in the full glare of the public, because those horrendous images, the striking images, were beamed across the globe. Everybody knew, everybody feared that this worst nightmare had come true.
I talk about that terrible accident and the implications and repercussions and the whole follow-on process and the criminal trial that followed it in the book. I and my family were going on holiday that day, and I got a call saying, ring British Airways, most urgent. And that was the first I heard of that awful accident in France. If you'd asked me beforehand how I'd react to a Concorde accident, I think I'd have probably said it won't happen. The airplane's very safe, and it would be terrible for the aviation project. But it wasn't like that. It was all about the people. And my first reaction was to ring my counterpart in Air France. And he had just arrived at the accident scene and was describing to me in detail what he saw. And after the initial shock and the feel of grief for the families and their friends of those that had perished, the initial reaction is, let's find out what happened and make sure it can never happen again. And that, over a period of eventually a year, is what we did. We found out what happened. We made modifications to the airplane. We put the airplane back into service. Now, for British Airways, that was a huge success. It meant that our regular customers could travel on Concorde again. Unfortunately for Air France, it was slightly different. It was their accident. It did very much dent their Concorde operational pride. And they made a decision that they wanted to stop operating the airplane. And because it was a joint project, it meant that British Airways would have had to fund all of the support costs, which we just could not do. So we had to stop operating again. They stopped in May 2003. We stopped in October 2003, not directly because of the accident, but because of the commercial pressures that came after the accident when Air France decided that they were stopping operations and we'd have to pick up the whole bill. And of course, I was then at that stage, I argued vehemently that we shouldn't stop, but my argument didn't carry the day. So then you've got a choice, haven't you? Do you throw your toys out of the pram or do you carry on with collective responsibility? I chose option B and was put in charge of the retirement program to try and make sure that Concorde was retired with dignity, honoring 27 years of successful supersonic operations, and it wasn't awake. And I think we succeeded in doing that. And most people were very, very pleased to see the wonderful celebration around the end of this marvelous aeroplane.
Strange to think it's 20 years ago, isn't it? I mean, just boom, and time doesn't time fly again, pardon the pun, when you're having fun. You must miss seeing her up there. Do you think she could have continued? I mean, she obviously there are updates, but she was, like I said, in the early 21st century, Sky, she certainly didn't look out of place.
Well, she still looks like a 21st century aeroplane today. And you're absolutely right. She could have carried on the technical side, probably to about 2015, 2016. I'm very lucky. I'm vice chair of trustees at Brooklands Museum in Weybridge. And we've got the Concorde simulator there, the very one that all the British Airways pilots and flight engineers were trained on. And it flies. And it flies actually better than it did when we had it, because 20 years on, computers and visuals have moved on. And I fly that very frequently with members of the public who come along and they'll sit in the captain's seat with me in the co-pilot seat instructing them. And they'll do a takeoff, they'll fly it round, they'll land it, and I get a chance to fly it. And, of course, it flies just like the real thing. So although the aeroplane hasn't flown for 20 years, the simulator's flown, and the simulator is actually a full real Concorde cockpit. So I still get my adrenaline buzz from flying that, but I end up where I started from, which is a bit of a disappointment.
And people still talk, I was doing a news piece the other day, people saying, oh, well, there's new plans for a space airliner. It'll get you London to Sydney in 2.5 hours. We've been doing this for 50 years, I think, you know. And of course, the Soviet Union tried to put up, was it the Topolov back in the days of their idea of Concorde, which never really worked. It's a project, I think, that we can safely say we'll never see the like of Concorde again.
Well, I'm slightly different perspective to that. My glass is always half full rather than half empty. My daughter, who's 29, is an airline pilot, and her ambition is to fly supersonically, having flown supersonically as a six-year-old child. I believe there will be another supersonic airliner. There are a number of companies who've been working on it. The one at the moment that seems to be at the most developed stage is Boom Aerospace in the States. They've developed an airplane called the Overture, which remarkably looks very similar to Concorde. And when I mentioned that to the chief designer there, he said, well, it kind of shows you got the design right first time. And their airplane is going to be a little bit slower, about Mach 1.7, slightly fewer passengers, maybe 55 in the initial iteration, but a longer range, meeting all current environmental restraints. And the operation will be commercially offering to the customer a much more attainable seat. It won't just be all one class like Concorde was. Would you fly in your travel class, be it tourist, club, business, or first, and pay 20% more to get there in half the time? If that's the proposition, if you think about it, lots of people would like to do that. And the route structure will be much, much more comprehensive than Concorde was. Yes, we went on lots of places to special flights. Concorde went to over 276 destinations around the world. But the Concorde operation was limited just basically to all those destinations with big oceans between. And Concorde was limited basically to the eastern coast of the United States. But the new airplane could go pretty much anywhere in the world. Indeed, Japan Airlines have options for it. So I'm optimistic. I think there will be another supersonic airliner. And if there is, I certainly hope I'll get the opportunity to fly on it, if not to fly it.
The book is called Concorde, The Thrilling Account of History's Most Extraordinary Airlines, by Mike Bannister, who I've been speaking to today. Mike, if people want to follow you or find out more about the book, is there a website? Can they find you on social media? Where can they track you down?
Yeah, I'm around on social media. Just Google me, or alternatively, go onto your favorite bookseller or online or in shops and stores. The paperback version is actually published today. And the hardback version came out last September, and the publishers tell me they're very pleased and the sales are going well. It was interesting. I was thinking about doing it in all the years since I retired, and eventually I read a wonderful book called Harrier 807 by a guy called Roland White. And at the end of it, it said, if you've liked this book, email me and tell me. So I thought, you know, I will. I won't get a reply. So I did email him. I did get a reply because it turns out he's not just an author. He's a major publishing editor for Penguin Random House. The next day I got a reply saying, we need to talk. And that was the beginning of 2.5 years of actually writing the book. And it's great fun. It was huge fun because I was doing something out of my comfort zone. I met people I otherwise never would have met. And people have been extremely generous in their comments about the readability and the story. So, yeah, from my perspective, it's been 2.5 years very well spent.
And you know, as a pilot who has a checklist of things to do and the walk around and everything like that, presumably putting a book together on Concorde, you obviously had the same sort of checklist and things to include and things not to. It must have, like I said, a different discipline.
Yeah, it is a totally different discipline, but there's certain things read across. Getting it right in your mind beforehand. I'd kind of written 2/3 of it just in my mind. It's getting that writing onto paper in a way that is readable and making sure you cover all the aspects and trying not to be too blinkered looking at it from a pilot's point of view, but try and have a much broader field of view looking at it both from the technical side and the customer's side and the side of the public who in the UK and France in particular were so supportive of the airplane because fundamentally they paid for the development of the aircraft in the first place. So it's trying to appeal to a very broad audience. It's not just a geeky aviation book. It's a book about Concorde that will hopefully tell the whole story of this wonderful and amazing airplane.
And if there's just a one moment where you can sit back and remember a highlight from the many, is it looking out and seeing, you know, seeing seeing two sunrises or watching those 747s going backwards? What would it be?
Gosh, that's difficult. There are so many highlights. I guess if you pin me down to one, it would be for Her Majesty's the Queen's Golden Jubilee in 2002, where I flew Concorde down the Mall in London towards Buckingham Palace in formation with the 9 Hawk aircraft of the RAF Red Arrows Formation Aerobatics Team. We were doing 325 miles an hour at 1,000 feet, 300 meters down the Mall towards Buckingham Palace. And we could see Her Majesty standing on the balcony waving. She was wearing this bright flame orange outfit. And I kind of expected all of that, you know, seeing Her Majesty, seeing Buckingham Palace flying with the Red Arrows. What I didn't expect was the surprise of seeing well over 1 million people on the ground beneath, waving and cheering and waving flags and jumping up and down, down the Mall, across the parks, over the bridges. That was sensational. And they were cheering and waving at the airplane that I'd been honored and privileged to fly for all those years. And that memory is so strong in my mind, that definitely will never fade.
Yeah, I will always remember Concorde coming in over London. It's one of my favorite memories of London at the time. The book is called Concorde. It's by Mike Bannister. Mike, we almost did the Cardinal Sin and crashed the news of having so much fun with this. But Mike Bannister, the book's going to be available via our own virtual bookstore as well. But Mike Bannister, thank you so much for your time today.
A great pleasure. Have a good day.